Hey guys, welcome to episode 176 of The True Crime Couple. I'm Kay.
And I'm John.
We hope that you are all having a good week, and we are excited to bring a whole nother episode to you. The case that I have for you today is a complicated one, with a lot of players and a lot of moving parts. But before I begin, I just wanted to let the audience know that this week's episode is going to involve discussions of suicide and suicide ideations. If this is something that is difficult to hear about, this episode may not be for you. It is also important to know that there's always help available to you. I will provide information in the show notes, but remember you can call or text 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, to speak with someone today. Okay, so with that being said, John, I know that I'm going to ask you if you're ready to hear something crazy, and I know that you always say yes, but this is truly insane.
I am super prepared for this. You know, between earthquakes and eclipses, we're ready. Let's do this.
A lot happening. We did have an earthquake. I appreciate people reached out and asked if we were okay. We're good. We also, it's so funny, we posted and from Death Do Less Part podcast commented that like this is something they're used to on the West Coast all the time, which is so true that we know nothing of the earthquake world. So like what we dealt with was like nothing compared to other places. Like, yes, there was some serious stuff that happened, like water main breaks or like some apartment complexes had some issues and stuff. But now we understand you, West Coast people.
It's true. I mean, and also, let's be fair, the West Coast has had decades to build infrastructure to help the situation.
That's
where
true.
We have never had to do that. So you know, I mean, it's different. That's almost like saying, you know, in Arizona, you know, they know how to deal with snowstorms. It's the same thing.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, right. It's like when it snows in like Florida and they're like, we don't even know what salt is for the roads.
Exactly. So. Right.
Yeah. So I think this case is going to be just as crazy for you.
Well, I'm buckled up and ready to go.
So today's case spans three countries and the course of 10 years. It begins as separate tragic cases of young individuals gone too soon. But when a 64-year-old self-admitted armchair detective gets involved, she slowly began to connect all the dots. And she figured out that something horrible was happening on the internet.
Police say the suspect, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, has confessed to the killings of 11 people whose remains were found in his apartment.
We are all evil in some form or another, are we not?
Lock your doors, lock your windows. If you have the ability to provide additional security devices, then by all means do so.
I want to begin our case with 18-year-old Nadia Kijiji. Nadia, as described by her brother, who was 11 years her senior, was an inquisitive and smart girl who was in her first year of college during the 2007 to 2008 school year. Growing up, she had many friends from her neighborhood, and she maintained a paper route to make money. Nadia is also stunningly beautiful, with lush dark brown hair and expressive large hazel green eyes, which she emphasized the way we loved to do in 2008, with waterline eyeliner and black mascara. Nadia was a very intelligent girl. She excelled in school and was very proud of all the work that she had done. She was known to be a bit of an overachiever. But even with all the schoolwork she did and the paper route, she still found time on Saturdays to volunteer at a local soup kitchen. She truly was a kid who did it all. Mark explained, her brother, in an interview with People magazine, that when it came time for his sister to pick a university to study at, that she wanted to pick one that was close to her hometown of Brampton, Ontario, but also not close enough that she could receive surprise visits from home. Like, she wanted to be a little bit far away, but not too far away. And in my experience, this is what most teens want. They want independence, but in a comfort zone. And that makes sense. It's the first time that they're going to be embarking into the world on their own. And it's exciting, but it's also really scary. And this is what led her to decide on Carleton University, which is located just under 500 kilometers from Brampton, which is 310 miles for us Americans. This was further away than her parents wanted, but they also understood that their youngest child wanted to spread her wings, find herself, and also go to a really good university in which she could excel academically. Carleton University in Ottawa, with an acceptance rate of 21%, was a wonderful school to attend, and certainly a great accomplishment. Again, according to Mark, Nadia's goal was to go on to law school and become a lawyer. He said that his sister's quick wit and her smart mouth would serve her well in a courtroom. And that's such an older brother thing to say.
That's actually really funny.
At first, Nadia seemed to be enjoying herself at college. Her brother said that he had seen on Facebook that she was enjoying the partying life on campus and that she had even begun to post video diary entries on YouTube. While she was doing this, she was using an alias, so she wasn't like, there was safety involved in her posting these video diaries. And she would post fun, upbeat things like a closet try-on montage, which was very like a la Carrie in Sex and the City. But Mark, knowing his sister well, understood that there was a lot more to the pictures from the party being posted and the fun videos being uploaded. He knew that the course load that his sister took on was heavy, and he also knew that she strived for perfection in everything she did. And him, being 11 years older, knew that soon something would have to give, because Nadia was taking a lot on. She was taking hard classes and trying to maintain a very active social life. And in your first year of college, that's a recipe for burnout, and that's something a lot of college freshmen suffer from. Mark also knew that Nadia was putting a lot of pressure on herself because of the high aspirations she had. And to her, there was no room for failure. And sometimes that's what college life is about. You know, when you go off on your own, there are failures, but she wasn't very accepting of that. So he knew that her constant need for perfection was going to wear her out.
Oh, yeah. I think it definitely takes its toll. You know, I mean, I think that when you're dealing with, you know, trying to fit in and trying to, you know, continue to have good grades and stuff and putting yourself out there and meeting new people, all of those are such stressors that maybe you weren't as accustomed to, or maybe like the school, the high school that you came from, you know, it was a small one, or even if it's a bigger one, I mean, you know everyone, you've been there for years.
Right.
So this is, it's like removing the rug from underneath you, you know?
Yeah. So within the first few months of Nadia being at school, she met a young woman who was studying contemporary dance at the School of Dance in Ottawa through a mutual friend. The dance school was located very close to both the University of Ottawa and Carleton University. So all the students who attended those schools often became familiar with each other. There's actually a lot of colleges in this area of Ottawa, so it's like known as kind of like a college town place. According to this student, Pasquale Jensen, Nadia's friend hooked the two girls up for a blind date. While remembering that first date that the two had together, Pasquale recalled that she had been nervous. Nadia was very beautiful, and this would be the first date that she would have with a girl. And from what she was told, it would also be Nadia's first time having a date with a girl. Pasquale said that the date had gone well, that the conversation flowed so easily. Nadia was not just beautiful, but funny and intelligent, and they had a lot in common. The two stayed at the coffee shop that they met in for 6 or 7 hours. The workers had to kick them out because they were closing up. So that's a sign of a good first date. Pasquale said that she left that night knowing that she wanted to see Nadia again. The two girls began seeing each other, and their relationship was exciting because they were exploring their sexuality and their feelings for each other, so they were never officially dating. Pasquale said that they did fun things like go out to parties. Nadia would do tarot card readings for her, and she would also read her the poetry that she had written. It was apparent that Pasquale had fallen very hard for Nadia. She explained that the two of them had a very thoughtful and fun relationship. The two never officially began dating, however. Because Nadia was exploring her sexuality, as many people do in college, and also taking the time to meet as many new people as possible, because you want to, you know, this is a crazy time. Like, you're experiencing life without the parameters of your parents for the first time. So you're kind of taking it all on. And you're trying to meet as many people as possible, especially your freshman year, so you don't get roped into one friend group. And this was the place to do that because this section of Ottawa had many universities and it was that great atmosphere. So because of that, it seemed like Nadia didn't want to tie herself down into a relationship. She also, we'll learn later, had just gotten out of a long-term relationship that she had. So I think that's why she never, you know, officially started dating Pasquale. And maybe she was still exploring her sexuality. We don't really have answers too much about where Nadia's headspace was with all of that. But there was a lot happening in her life.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, right? I mean, I always think to myself, like, that's the time when you do find yourself and you do explore and you do in more ways than one, you know, just in general, right? Like, I mean, this is your time to grow yourself.
Right. When you have that freedom too, to do it and feel comfortable in kind of your own skin. But it was as Christmas break approached that those who knew Nadia at school and then later her family began to notice that something was not right with her. Pasquale recalled in an interview that she had a date planned with Nadia, but when it came time for the two to meet, she was not answering her phone or her dorm room door. Eventually, Pasquale decided to leave. 2 days later, she received a text message from Nadia that explained that she was sorry about what had happened, that she wasn't feeling great, and that when Pasquale had texted and came by the room, she'd been asleep. Nadia went on to explain that she hadn't been feeling well, that she was feeling overwhelmed and she just needed to take a break from everything. She said that maybe in January, when she returned from break, if she was feeling better, that the two of them could reconnect. Pasquale, who cared about Nadia, gave her the space that she requested, but she said that it had been the first sign that things weren't great with her, meaning that whatever Nadia had been struggling with or from, she had been doing so seemingly in silence because the image of Nadia that Pasquale had gotten was that, you know, she was doing really great in school, she was having fun, and this was the first sign that she saw that, you know, maybe things were not perfect. When Nadia returned home in December of 2007, her family noticed a change in her as well. They recalled that she wasn't the same bubbly, outgoing girl that had left for college. They had known her as the girl who craved having fun, wanting to be around people. However, the girl who returned seemed to have a significant change in her mood and personality. Nadia was very closed off. She spent hours and hours in her room, not wanting to be around others and socialize as she once had. So they were all confused and concerned for her. Okay, but before we get any further into Nadia's case, we're going to take a break here to talk about the sponsor of today's show, Fume. We cover some of the worst crimes that humanity has seen, but there is one more that we haven't covered yet. And that's how, as a society, we've just become addicted. But there are ways to break those bad habits, and changing your mindset can help you get rid of those habits. Think, it's not about giving up, but switching it up. And Fume can help take your habit and simply make it better, healthier, and a whole lot more enjoyable. Fume is an innovative, award-winning, flavored air device that does just that, give you deliciously flavored air in a variety of amazing flavors. Instead of vapor, Fume uses flavored air, and instead of electronics, Fume is completely natural. And instead of harmful chemicals, Fume uses delicious flavors. You get it. Instead of bad, Fume is good. It's a habit you're free to enjoy and makes replacing your bad habit easy. Your Fume comes with an adjustable airflow dial and is designed with movable parts and magnets for fidgeting, giving your fingers a lot to do, which is helpful for de-stressing and anxiety while breaking your habit. Fume has an amazing taste. We love the refreshing mint flavor. It's so fresh, and we weren't expecting it to be so potent and so good. It's like having your favorite herbal tea on the go whenever you want it. It's very relaxing. The wood design and light feel make it a product that is easy and fun to use. Plus, Fume just released a magnetic stand for your Fume, so there's no more losing it around the house. It's built with fidgeting in mind so you can spin your Fume around on it. Start the year off right with a good habit by going to tryfume.com/TCC and getting the journey pack today. Fume is giving listeners of the show 10% off when they use our code TCC to help make starting the good habit that much easier. Okay, let's get back to the show. Nadia was going through a lot at this point, and I just want to backtrack here a little bit. Nadia had been in a long-term relationship with a boy that she had known back in Brampton, where she had grown up. We do not know all of the details, but sometime during her first semester, her boyfriend ended their relationship. We also know that she is away from home for the first time, starting college. And remember, she strived for perfection in her academics. She was also trying to make friends, potentially experimenting or questioning her sexuality. So there's a lot going on in her life and a lot of change happening all at once. So this, I am sure, contributed to her change in mood and behavior. But the change in mood and behavior became over time very worrisome. It is through Nadia's video diary entries, later released records from Carleton University, as well as the testimonies of those that were close to Nadia or lived with her at school. In combination, they tell the story of a young woman who was going through a mental health crisis, a crisis that her parents were never made aware of by the proper authorities. So now I'm going to get into the details of Nadia's life, and I'm going to discuss some difficult topics. Those topics involve miscarriage, suicide, and suicide ideation. Throughout the course of her YouTube video posts, the escalation of Nadia's mental health crisis is evident. She goes from a happy and ambitious young woman to someone who is desperately reaching out for help. In one video, she stated, "Yes, I am depressed. I have postpartum mood disorder, clinical depression, and insomnia." She asked herself, "So have you thought about suicide?" She answers, "Yes, I've thought about suicide." In reference to her diagnosis of postpartum mood disorder, depression, and insomnia, she explained in a later video that she had become pregnant after a condom had broke and the morning after pill did not work. I have not seen the video, but it is explained. And in that explanation, it states that she said that she had a miscarriage, and she felt that the miscarriage took away her ability to choose whether or not she wanted to keep that child. Also, let's not forget, she was dealing with a difficult breakup, exploring her sexuality, starting college. Now, these are all highly emotionally charged events occurring all at the same time, and it would be too much for even an adult to handle, let alone an 18-year-old child.
It's crazy that we have the archive of like all the videos. Now, were these like for the public to view? Like, was it on Facebook?
It was on YouTube that she was posting it, but in most of the videos, she had her face in some way blocked. So like she was posting these videos on YouTube, but not as Nadia Kijuji. Like it was under an alias.
I see. Okay. And that's really sad because you're having these people, you know that somebody that's watching these videos is looking at her and saying like, this poor woman, like she's going through a lot. Like, I wish that, you know, we could do something about it. You know what I mean?
Right. And get her help.
Yeah. Cause you're seeing this on YouTube. That's crazy.
Yeah. And you know, these are the early days of YouTube where things like this are going to be posted and they're not going to be flagged or taken down or reported for good reasons. Meaning like report it because this person needs help.
Yeah.
In other videos, she stated, "I can barely string together a cohesive sentence or two. Like when I'm speaking, I can't put it down on paper or write a test or an essay. I can't function." And that was what the doctor said we should focus on, getting me to function. In another video, She talked about how her doctor was unwilling to give her medicine so she could sleep, but how she wanted to sleep very badly. That her lack of sleep, or her insomnia, was making her mind race and inhibiting her from resting and becoming happy again. Now, I know I keep mentioning a doctor, so keep that in the back of your mind because there's going to be more on that doctor in a little bit. In another one of the videos, she said that she couldn't stand school and that she couldn't even go to class. She added that she thought she was going to lose the semester. She said, "It seemed like it would be easy, you know, just starting to go to class and do your work, but I can't." Now, this is a major red flag because this is a girl who has been very studious, and that is one thing that she had always taken pride in was her work. And the fact that her academics were suffering shows that there's something really big happening here, because it is when you see these massive changes in behaviors that someone should be spoken to and they should be encouraged to go to the proper people, which it does seem like Nadia at this point is going to, because especially in these videos, she talks about seeing a doctor and a counselor.
Right. Now, were her parents or her family members aware of any of this?
Well, yeah, that's something that I was going to get into, but I can say now that when she goes to seek help, and when she has to go seek help, which I'll explain later, the university never makes her parents aware of the help that she's receiving on campus.
I feel like that's not good at all.
No.
I mean, you would think that they would, though, you know?
Well, okay, so double-edged sword, she's 18 years old, right? So technically she's a legal adult. However, she is attending a university that her parents are paying for. She is on their health insurance, but she's receiving these services through the school, so it's a little bit different than just billing insurance. But also, in addition to that, there are laws that if someone's physical health is in danger, that kind of breaks that, I don't want to say HIPAA laws because I know that's the United States, but it breaks that barrier of like a parent not being told about something, because Nadia has admitted that she is thinking of suicide. So for that reason alone, her parents should have been contacted immediately.
I think so, especially that this is her first time away from everything that, you know, that she knows. I feel like it's going to be harder to ground yourself.
Right.
Especially when you're dealing with all these things.
Right. So the answer to that is that no, her parents don't know. And this is what has been happening with Nadia the whole first semester. And from what I could see, I don't know if this was the case when Nadia was in school, but it seems like Carleton was on a trimester system. And in my experience, I've seen with past students of mine who go to schools that are on a trimester system, because most American universities are based on a two-semester system. The students who go to trimester schools struggle because it's less breaks and a lot of academics. So that is also a very taxing schedule. Okay. But anyway, this makes sense that when Nadia comes home from Christmas break, that she's not herself. And her parents recognize that she's not herself. But again, they haven't been told by the university about what truly is going on with Nadia. And one other reason why I brought up the whole trimester thing here at this time is because Nadia was not home for an extended period of time. So when you're on a two-semester system at university, how most American schools do it, you're Christmas break or your winter break is actually a month long. She was only home for about a week and a half. So her parents were able to see, okay, maybe there's a change in behavior, but they could also attribute it to, well, maybe she's missing her friends at school. Maybe she's stressed because finals, you know, like there's many things.
I see what you're saying, because it had like a not enough time has passed while she's there to show any signs that something is wrong. I get that.
And also when you come home from college the first time, especially for an extended period of time, like a week, things are completely different. You're used to going out all the time, being able to do what you want. So maybe you're catching up on sleep at home. So you're staying in your room. So it's not like it's outside the realm of things that have happened to other students who returned back from college for the first time. But it was hard for them to recognize. But they did recognize that something was off.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that they had some inkling to something wasn't 100% right. Something was off, you know.
But Nadia was a very responsible girl, so and very capable. So they, you know, trusted her and trusted that she would reach out. What she did, she just wasn't getting the best responses. But we'll get into that. So thinking that maybe she was just going through a lot and had a lot to do, Nadia's parents brought her back to school in early January. When Nadia returned to school, the same struggles of the first semester came out. She was having trouble academically, emotionally, and socially. Sometimes it would seem like things were okay, and other times Nadia withdrew completely from her friends at school. When she returned to school, she did message Pasquale again, but never made mention of meeting up with her again or wanting to continue to pursue anything romantic. So Pasquale decided to let their relationship or situationship kind of like fizzle out. However, in February, the mutual friend that Nadia and Pasquale shared asked Pasquale if she wanted to attend a frat party with the two of them. So she decided to go. She said that at that party, she had a great time, and she felt as if she was reconnecting with Nadia again, that they were having fun at the party, and that at one point, you know, in the midst of them all having fun, Nadia went and she presumed that she was just headed to go to the bathroom. However, she never returned. So when the two girls attempted to get in contact with her, they were unable to get a hold of her, and this made them worry. Later, they would learn that Nadia was just no longer in the mood and wanted to leave. So, like, this is another example of, like, a social struggle. Like, even though seemingly she's having a great time at this party, she has to remove herself from it.
That's really sad, you know. But what worries me, and look, I don't know much about any of the a lot of the talks that we're covering about. You know, I don't want to claim or act like I do. But I think that it's scary because she is retreating. Right. And then I find that if that's happening, then I feel like then somewhere you're going to seek that, almost like a form of self-medicating, but socially. So like if you're not going to go out and be with people that you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to like meet people online? Are you going to talk to people on Facebook? Like
I see what you're saying.
Right. So not self-medicating, but like socializing. Yeah. You know, like, but like, you don't, you know, if you do it online, you don't know who you're talking to, you don't know who you're dealing with. That happens all the time. Yeah. I think whether or not you are dealing with something as serious as, you know, suicidal tendencies or suicidal thoughts, mm-hmm. you know, things like, I think that's in general, I think a lot of people do that where they retreat and then they just go online and do it.
Right. And then you never know who you're truly talking right. to.
Even, a great example of this is even if you play video games, let's just say, I'm sorry, I'm just throwing this out here because it makes sense. If you're playing video games, sometimes people play video games for the social aspect where it's not even about the game. And then that's where they find their friends and like that's just where they hang. And then they almost feel like there's no need to even go outside and meet people. So even though I know it's different, I'm saying I wonder where she's going to fill that void.
I see what you're saying. Whereas because of her depression, her insomnia, that's kind of keeping her withdrawn into her room. But because she's a kid, she is craving that socialization in a way. So she's going to reach out within her comfort zone, which is her dorm room. So that's through the internet.
Right. And that even makes sense what I'm saying, I think, a little bit, because she even reached out via text message, you said, to Pasquale, right?
Yeah.
So like it's over a communication device, but not in person. And then when it was, she left.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So this also leads us to another important date in the expansive timeline of this case. Sunday, March 9th, 2008. Nadia had just returned to school from home, where she had been the week before for reading week, which is a week during a university's term where no teaching takes place because the students are preparing for a midterm or final or some big test that's happening. One of Nadia's roommates said that between 11:20 and 11:30, she heard Nadia's door open and then close. She said that she found it odd that the next morning, Nadia's door was locked and loud music was playing from inside. She said the other roommates knocked, but they failed to get a response. This worried them. More on that later, like as to why they got so alerted by this. So they decided to go get a security guard. The security guard was able to get the door open, and inside they found Nadia's wallet with money left inside, about $200, two things she would never leave without, but no Nadia. Her roommates checked her social media to see if she had indicated where she was going, but it seemed like if she had gone anywhere, she only stepped out for a bit. And the only thing she had posted was a status update that read, and remember Facebook would do this where like your status update would be your name and then you'd add to it, like it already say K, so I would add, is going to the mall with friends.
I remember that.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So her status read, Nadia will someday be loved. She is loved, but she just in her state cannot recognize
right.
that.
The clues that we need might be in the messages that she's putting on Facebook. I think that Facebook.
And through her messages,
yes.
like her posts on YouTube.
I think both of those sources, if we're dealing with something sinister, I think could be very, you know, positive as far as like to find out what's going on or what happened or where or wherever she is.
Yeah, and her computer in general, because she spends so much time on it. Because Nadia could not be found, her parents were contacted. Nadia's father, Mohammed, texted Mark, her older brother, to let him know that Nadia was missing. Mark, his father, and Nadia's mother, which is his stepmother, because Nadia and Mark are half-siblings, went to the school to aid in the search and figure out what was happening. They all feared that foul play was involved, and the worst things you could imagine were popping in their minds as they were driving from Brampton to Carleton University, which was in Ottawa. So it's like a 300-mile drive.
That's really far. And I mean, and it's normal. You have no idea what's going on.
Mark said that he remembered going into his little sister's dorm room and noticing what was missing, apart from her jacket, ID, and cell phone, was her ice skates. He thought to himself, and later said to investigators, that it just didn't make sense. He got her wanting to just grab a few things and maybe go out skating quick, but it didn't make sense that she would go out skating at all because there was a foot and a half of snow outside. It just seemed impractical. Also, if you were going out ice skating quickly, she wouldn't have left her music blaring with her door locked from the inside. So the family was really thinking that something awful had happened to Nadia, like someone had done something to her. And then that was when the bombshell was dropped on them. To make a frantic situation even worse, the family was told about a few incidents that had taken place since Nadia had been attending school. Now, the details are shaky. We don't have them 100%. And I can't hammer them out like through various sources, but this is what I could gather. The 18-year-old had been taken to the hospital in an ambulance the previous November or December after threatening to cut herself with a razor blade in the Oasis restaurant, which is located on campus. Nadia's parents had also learned that the students that lived in Nadia's residence hall had contacted campus security to alert them that they knew Nadia to be suicidal. This, as you can imagine, infuriated Nadia's parents. They had no clue that this had been happening or that their daughter was suicidal. Remember I said I would get back to the doctor and her roommates calling security? Well, this is what I meant. Nadia had been seeing an on-campus doctor, one who, after speaking with her, allegedly said that because of her insomnia, they would like to give her sleeping pills, but were hesitant to because of her suicidal ideations. In an interview with CBC News, Nadia's mother, Deborah, said, If they're not going to intervene and advise us, at the very least, they're afraid to put her on sleeping pills because she's suicidal. Why not put her in the bloody hospital where she can be monitored and given sleeping pills and get some sleep and then monitor her from there? Of course, I'm angry about it. It's a very difficult thing to deal with. It is difficult to hear that the family wasn't notified and how Nadia fell and seemingly was not listened to or monitored properly after all of these incidents occurred. This is obviously why her roommates, when they didn't get a response from knocking on her door, went immediately to security because they thought something had happened to her.
Right, because of previous incidents.
Correct.
Now, look, it's hard to throw around the blame game here, and I really don't want to do that, but I do find it complicated because, yes, she is an adult. She's at school. Like, I get that there's certain laws and things of that nature, but
she's a danger to herself.
You're dealing with someone who's dealing with, you know, something very serious. Now, if it was just something, you know, run of the mill, something like that's just common, of course not.
It makes sense. Like, one common thing on campus is that students always get STDs. Of course, don't tell my mom and dad that. But, you know, this is something that is really serious.
Right.
One lasting question I have about this that I couldn't find an answer to was in regards to the insurance. Because if I remember in my first year, like until I was 26, I was under my parents' insurance plan. So it's almost like they would know if I had an ambulance drive me somewhere. But Canada's different than America.
Right.
Remember. So like we're used to like, oh my God, my parents would get 5 million bills if something like that happens, but their healthcare is different.
Right, their healthcare system is different. That's true. So yeah, I don't know, but I feel like this is extremely serious. They should have been notified because it's not just one incident, it's several. And it's not just, you know, going to the doctor and not being able to get sleeping pills because of her tendency, right? Or the fact that she could harm herself. It's more than that. It's more than that. She's done things in public and other people around her know that she's not well. So I think that's really messed up that they didn't do that.
I agree. And now imagine finding that all out after your daughter's now missing.
It's wrong.
Right.
It's wrong.
So now that everyone was on the same page, the police, the university, and Nadia's family, the search and investigation were underway. Everyone who knew Nadia was contacted and asked about her whereabouts. No one had any clue where she was. Nadia's face was broadcasted all over the news. Her father handed out flyers to anyone who would take the time around the area, and for 18 hours a day in the freezing Canadian winter, Muhammad was handing out these flyers, and he was so highly emotional, as you can imagine. He also made numerous media interviews and appearances, breaking down in tears, pleading for his daughter's safe return.
That's really sad. Another thing I wanted to just say, just because I forgot to mention it when we were talking about it, you would think that they would have done like a 24-hour psychiatric hold. I don't know how it works there, but I'm pretty damn sure that does exist. And you can sign yourself out as a legal adult after, I believe, 24 hours.
So, well, like, maybe that was done. They just weren't notified.
Right. But what I'm saying is that would be your perfect opportunity to psychiatric hold, do what needs to be done, and then notify a family member.
Yeah.
Like, how does that not happen? Maybe I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something here, but it just, as you're telling me this story, it sounds horrible.
You're getting mad.
Because if something did happen to this woman that could have been prevented, I'm saying that it's not somebody that actually murdered her, or which is terrible. But if this was something that could have been prevented, and all it was just some help, and you know, because she was dealing with mental health issues, that angers me.
Well, we've covered many cases involving universities where it's sad because parents seemingly have this like false sense of security that, oh, I'm sending my kid away, but they're going to be safe because they're here. And that doesn't necessarily always seem to happen.
No, it doesn't, which is sad.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're spending, in some cases, $70,000 a year to send your child there.
Right. You're hoping that your kid comes out with a bright future ahead of them and all these things. And then you have something like this happen.
Right.
Sorry, guys. Just a little. Angers me a little bit.
No, it's I'm sure everyone feels the same way you do. At this point, Nadia had been missing for 5 days. The foot search for her had not been strong, something that the Kijiji family was very vocal about not being happy with. The Ottawa Police Service stated that the ground search was complicated because of the fact that it had just snowed 3 feet. In the meantime, the police wanted to conduct a different kind of search. They confiscated anything from her dorm room that they thought could help them with their investigation, and her computer was one of those things. Analysts from the police department ran a forensic analysis of Nadia's computer. What they found was shocking.
Tell me, what'd they find?
It was discovered that Nadia had been in communication with someone who was using the username Falcon Girl. In emails, it was revealed that her name was Cammy D. The two had met in a chat room for individuals that had thoughts of suicide. The two met after Nadia had posted on a public forum of a chat room. They communicated sometimes through Messenger there, through the chat room, you know, space, and also through email. From what the detectives could gather through the conversations that they had between the two women was that Nadia was rapt with attention at everything Cammy had to say, and that she believed she found this like soulmate in Cammy. Now, Cammy D was a 31-year-old nurse. She lived in the United States, and she told Nadia that she could relate with how she was feeling and that she had too felt a similar way and had and like was currently feeling that way.
I feel like this is very dangerous.
Yeah, I think that herein lies like some problems, right? So say these forums or these chat rooms are set up to help people. Because they're not monitored by professionals, they could take a very dangerous turn. And that's the case with many disorders. You know, like we see like similar things in high school. Even though we teach children about eating disorders, we always refrain from giving them projects or things to do regarding eating disorders on their own. Because what we have found is that when students are seeking information on something like an eating disorder, they could come across those bad sites.
Right. In their research. Right.
So it's seemingly like this is happening here. Whereas she's reaching out in these forums for help, she's now communicating with people that feel a similar way to her.
Exactly. I don't know. I was going to say the word groupthink, but I know that that's not.
Well, it's exacerbating the feeling.
I guess so, yeah.
Because they're commiserating together and it's not improving the depression.
No, I think it's exacerbating the problem, not just for, let's say, Nadia in question, but anybody else that might actually truly feel that way.
Yeah.
You know, and not just that. There's another layer to it, too, that is why the red flag went up for me. There is no way to vet these people. We're dealing with, what, 2008?
Well, yeah, it's early 2008.
Okay. Well, it's still relevant. You know, catfish are big, too. You can't forget that. You know, we're dealing with chat rooms and Facebook and other places, too. You have no idea who people are. So if there's no way on these forums or whatever, wherever she's going.
Well, in any of these chat rooms, there's no way.
Sure. But that's what I'm saying. So you have no idea who you're talking to. So you're a 31-year-old nurse. Are you really a nurse? Do you really live in the United States? Are you really a Falcon Girl or whatever her name is? It could be a dude. It could be anybody is what I'm trying to get at.
Right.
So, you know, and then the whole, oh, I'm a nurse. Well, is that to bring my guard down?
Well, here comes the bad part.
What?
She explained that because she was a nurse, and she definitely was a nurse based on the knowledge and information that she was sharing, or seemingly was so, that she knew the correct way to die by suicide because she was an emergency room nurse, is what she was basically saying, that she had seen people come in that had failed to complete suicide. So like she felt like she wanted to come on these forums and maybe help people. so she could assist them, that if they were to do it, it would be quick and painless versus the way that she had seen it happen.
Okay, so should, so this person thinks to the Grim Reaper and you know, Dr. Kevorkian.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's,
for lack of a better term.
I mean, that's ridiculous. See, that's what I'm saying, though. You know, like, that's dangerous.
Right. And in her messages, Cammy said that she was relieved to have found someone that shared similar thoughts as her. And she believed that she and Nadia could give strength to each other and that they should enter into a suicide pact.
Get out of here.
Yeah. Where they would both die by suicide around the same time, the one giving the other strength. Once this suicide pact was made, Cammy was very vocal about good ideas and best ways to die by suicide. Again, because she was a nurse, she kept saying she knew the best ways. She was very descriptive about the correct way to hang oneself, and it seemed as if she was really trying to push Nadia to die this way. Nadia, though, expressed a different idea altogether. She said that she wanted to spare her loved ones the pain of thinking that she died by suicide and instead wanted to stage her death as a skating accident on the Rideau River, which was close to campus. A skating accident.
God, this is like...
And remember what her brother said was missing from her dorm room.
Her skates. Yeah. You know, that's just so sad to hear.
It's tragic and disgusting.
It is. If we find out that this person, you know, is making her take her own life.
Well, essentially is in making the suicide pact, because without her communications with Cammy D., we don't know what Nadia's actions would have been. You know, where is the response? Where does the responsibility lie? And, you know, that's an interesting question, but let's continue with the investigation.
Please. You got to keep moving forward or I'm going to keep getting angry.
Okay. So after all of this information was revealed through their communication, the police are going to focus their search around the Rideau River, especially because of the final email that Nadia sent to Cammy. The final email from Nadia to Cammy read, "Hi, Cammy. I just thought I'd write you a quick note before I go. I'm feeling at peace now, and it makes me feel better knowing that I won't die alone now," because she thinks she's doing it. "I'm going through my computer files and deleting things I don't want people to find after I'm gone. I must say I'm feeling a lot better now I can talk to you. I'm glad that things are going to end together. I'm feeling confident. I want to go now, but there are too many people I care about." So that's saying I care about a lot of people, you know, that this, but this person's pushing her to do it because they're doing it together.
Right, exactly. And right, you know, we wouldn't be, we don't know what the windup would be, but I think that this is a nudge that didn't need to happen.
No, because Nadia was a very vulnerable and impressionable person, especially at this stage in her life. So the email goes on to say, "My cell phone number is," and she leaves her cell phone number. "If you try texting me on Monday and it doesn't go through, it means I jumped. The pain will be temporary and then it will be over. Thank you, Nadia." Detectives and the family knew that this was a useless search at that time of year. The river was basically frozen. And in places like Canada with harsh winters, if a body was truly what they were looking for, they knew they wouldn't find Nadia until the spring. As the search for Nadia intensified, the IP address of Cammy, or Falcon Girl, was traced.
Oh, good. Awesome.
It turned out she was a teenage girl.
She was. Okay.
They went, but remember, she said she was a 31-year-old nurse.
Right.
So they went to her home in Minneapolis, where she told Nadia that she had lived. They informed her father about the discussions that she'd been having online, because they wanted to ensure her safety as well. Because if this was a suicide pact, that meant that this girl was also going to be taking her life soon as well.
Exactly.
So the father assured them that he would be getting help for his daughter. And they left thinking, okay, well, we saved one person's life.
Okay.
6 weeks after her disappearance, a kayaker on the Rideau River called law enforcement to report that a body had washed up on the banks of the part of the thawing river that ran behind St. Paul University. When detectives and crime scene analysts got there, they reported that it was a hard sight to behold. Because of the time her body had been exposed to the elements, the remains were muddied, bruised, and excessively swollen. Through this, it could be seen that there were no apparent signs of trauma or foul play, and it did not take long for Nadia's body to be identified. The death of Nadia Kijuji is tragic in many ways. She was a girl who was desperate for help, a girl who reached out several times, and her pleas and warning signs fell upon deaf ears, or potentially got lost in a system that at the time might not have been equipped to handle the mental health crisis, was not equipped to handle the mental health crisis she was going through. This case has an important message at the crux of it, especially to those listeners with teens in their lives, because 1 in 5 teens goes through a mental health crisis. And us being there for them and helping them get the proper care they need from a professional is very important. But this is not where this case ends. It's only just the beginning. I want to backtrack here for a bit. Back during Nadia's disappearance, while the Ottawa police attempted to search the frozen Rideau River, a detective with the St. Paul, Minnesota Police Department received an email from someone in the UK on March 25th, 2008. The reason why this email was sent to him was because it was his job to investigate child exploitation on the internet, and the sender thought the information they had pertained to his area of expertise. I have parts of that letter.
Before you read this letter, let me just make sure I understand this correctly. So our main story here is taking place in Canada.
Correct.
This detective is in Minnesota.
And he gets an email from the UK.
The UK. Okay. Wow.
That's, remember I said it like spans three countries.
It does. Wow. That's,
and maybe more. We don't know.
Okay.
So here's the email that was sent from a woman in the UK to this detective.
Okay.
Dear sir, you don't know me, but I obtained your name and email through an online search. I understand your organization investigates crimes committed via the internet because he's part of like the Criminal Apprehension Bureau, specifically crimes involving young people and children. I've recently become aware of some behavior on the internet that has caused me a great deal of worry. Specifically, someone is trying to lure vulnerable people into forming suicide pacts with them and encouraging them to take their lives. They are offering advice on how best to kill themselves and then agreeing to watch and help them commit suicide via webcam.
What is wrong with people?
Oh, people? Or one person? This behavior is in and of itself bad enough, but they are also then not going through with the pact and continuing to target other desperate people and form suicide pacts with them. The forum for this behavior is a suicide chat room called Alt Suicide Holiday and another group called Alt Suicide Methods. The offender often makes contact with these vulnerable people via chat rooms and then continues conversations with them offline via email. I have collected this. Woman is amazing. True armchair detective. I have collected multiple email addresses used by this person. The name they use in the chat room is Lee Dow, and the emails are falcongirl507.
Oh, that's the person.
Yep, at blank.com. falcongirl5 at blank.com. And sometimes Lee Dow at blank.com and Cammy D. at blank.com.
This is crazy. But hold on. How do we know we could trust this person?
Well, we'll get there.
Okay. I'm just throwing it out there because
I know. It's still the internet.
I have questions. Yes. I have question flags here. It's weird that this is happening.
the letter goes on to, so the email goes on to say that the messages all say, or like, this person says they are from Minneapolis and they wanted to send this to them because they're a law enforcement organization in Minnesota. The detective that this email was sent to was Bill Hyder with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in Minnesota. It was an unusual email. The information was basic but troublesome, and it was not every day that he received an email from someone from a different country. So he reached out to the sender to learn more. The email came from a 64-year-old woman named Celia Blay from Maiden Bradley, England. She considered herself to be an anti-suicide advocate with a passion for protecting people. And it was through her work with that that she became the most unlikely of armchair detectives. Like, don't fuck with cats level armchair detective. Like, remember that documentary?
Oh, yeah, I do, actually, like, yeah.
She went in on this. And she basically did all the work for detectives.
Okay, so we have vetted her that...
We can trust Celia. She's a certified, like, badass woman.
Okay.
Okay. Good. The reason she had this passion was because she herself suffered from depression, and she was interested in helping others that may be going through something similar. She wanted to be a comfort to people during the times when they needed it most. To do this, she would communicate with them through forums and chat rooms. Celia would try to lift the spirits of others and show them that there was help and hope out there for them. She was careful to always direct those who she spoke to with medical professionals that could help them like they had helped her. So she was doing the right things using the correct methods.
Right.
In doing this, she had come across an internet site that she'd listed, the internet forums and chat rooms that she listed in that email. And it was there that she believed that something bad was happening. Something that needed to be stopped immediately. On this site, a teenager had told her that they had engaged in a conversation with someone named Lee Dow and that she had made a suicide pact with them. The teenager didn't go through with it, but they were very uncomfortable with the conversations that this Lee Dow was having with them and how aggressive they were being in kind of pushing them to commit the act. And how aggressive they were in pushing them to die by suicide.
That is so sick.
Yes. According to this teen, Dow was a female in their mid-20s who was living in Minnesota and working as an emergency room nurse. They would also go by the nickname of Cammy D or Falcon Girl.
So whoever this person is that has these aliases, they're going around doing it to a lot of people.
A lot of people.
This is crazy. Actually, like, this is unbelievable.
I know. I told you in the beginning. Like, this is wild.
I mean, it's bad enough that it's affecting one person.
Mm-hmm.
But to find out that it's multiple, it's crazy. I don't know what would give someone, the right to just think that it's okay to do that. You're crazy. You're wild, man.
And taking advantage of people at such a vulnerable part of time and part of their lives.
Like, you have some serious issues, dude. Whoever you are, you have problems.
Yeah.
To do that to others.
When Celia heard about this happening, she was appalled, like you are. That was not what the community of support was for. And something like a suicide pact was a very dangerous thing to begin among a community of people who were reaching out for help because they were in crisis. So she did what she did best. And she went about helping people. Celia was very active in warning people about Lee Dow and made multiple posts across multiple forums and chat rooms about them. She warned that this person was trying to lure people into suicide pacts and that they were dangerous. One of the people that came across Celia's warning message was a woman named Kat Lowe. Kat was on the forums because she was having a difficult time in her life. She was a mother of two who had been dealing with mental health struggles and had, as she put it, hit rock bottom. And that was why she turned to the internet for help and discussion. She was extremely vulnerable, and it was in one of these online chat rooms that she met Lee Dow. She thought the conversations were getting weird, and then she saw Celia's post and her suspicions were basically confirmed. Kat messaged Celia to thank her for the warning and say that, you know, this really was happening and she was doing it to multiple people. And that's how Kat and Celia became friends and began to work together. Well, Celia's warning messages caught the attention of a journalist, and Celia agreed to speak with her because she wanted to stop this Lee Dow person because she felt like she's putting up the warnings on the forums. And, you know, while she's doing that, people keep expressing to her these bizarre or scary conversations that they're having with this person. And she really felt like they were having bad intentions. And she thought that her warning messages maybe weren't enough. So that's why she agreed to work with the journalist, because she believed the journalist could get the message out there even further. So people were very wary of whoever this person was. Celia also spoke to Kat on a regular basis after their initial messaging. Kat let her know that even though she had stopped talking to Lee Dow and blocked the email that she had been corresponding, you know, with her through, this person made another email and was continuing to contact her.
Right, so they're just going to keep on doing this. Mm-hmm. Every time that, like, some light is shed on, hey, this person with that name is doing this, they change it.
Well, and if you block one email, they make another.
Right.
So both Celia and Kat agreed that this person has to be stopped. So they thought, you know, like, let's go on this mission to expose this person, because they're actively trying to get people to be involved in these suicide pacts that they are not following through with. So they decided that to do this, they would need Kat to get close with her again. So Kat shared her email with Lee Dow, and the two of them began to talk that way.
Okay, so we're setting up like a, almost like a sting operation.
Correct. Here. They wanted a photograph of her so that they could post it to warn people against her and report her to the authorities in different countries and the authorities in the United States where she's stating that she's from. However, when Kat went to chat with Lee Dow, the two agreed to turn their cameras on. But at first, she wasn't, like, in sight. And then finally, the camera caught sight of the person that was there sitting at the computer. And they had been shocked to see that it wasn't a 20-year-old nurse, but a middle-aged man.
I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. But why, man? Why would you do this? I need to know more.
Oh, well, there's more. And that wasn't just the extent of Celia's investigations. She had also gotten in contact with a woman named Elaine Drybrow. Through all of her postings and diggings, these two women somehow came in contact. So Elaine is going to tell Celia in June of 2008 that 3 years prior, so in 2005, her son had been in communication with Lee Dow and had died by suicide. This terrified Celia because this is the first time Celia has heard of someone actually dying by suicide after communicating with this person.
Right.
Everyone she has spoken to at this point had really only just had scary interactions.
Right. And if anything, this just kind of furthers her point that this person does need to be stopped.
Right. And this also terrified her because this had happened 3 years prior. So how many victims were under this man's belt?
Yeah. That's what I was trying to say earlier. Like, how long and how many people have been affected by this person?
Right. Elaine's son, Mark Drybrow, who lived in Coventry, was 32 years old and had struggled with mental illness for many years. Elaine had found out about the conversations her son had been having with Dow when she and her daughter discovered emails that Mark and Dow had been sending back and forth to each other when they went through Mark's computer. In the emails, Lee Dow, who stated she was a nurse, gave Mark instructions on how to properly hang oneself. I am not going to repeat those emails, but they are very detailed and very encouraging. According to the coroner's report from Coventry, Mark, who died on the 27th of July, 2005, as a result of hanging himself at his home, the official ruling was that he had taken his own life while going through severe psychiatric illness. The ligature marks were present in a way that showed he listened to the advice of Lee Dow. Now, I don't know this for certain, but I've read several things that alluded to the fact that they believed that potentially whoever is posing as Lee Dow was watching this suicide.
Like via like webcam or something? Yeah.
Yes. I mean, it was alluded to in some articles that I read and then not in others. So I don't know for certain. I don't want to speak for certain. But we'll get into how much they are accused of doing that, though, later.
Okay.
So the ligature marks show that at the very least, they listened to the advice in the emails, because where the ligature marks were on the neck, so that means through assistance of that person, he died by suicide in a specific way.
I hope that this person is held to the highest level of like accountability by law that could possibly happen here.
Yeah.
You know, because for lack of a better term, it's like when they say like, you know, the person didn't, you know, kill him, let's just say, but, you know, loaded a gun and handed it to him.
Right.
You know, like, you are just as responsible, even though you didn't harm him physically. You put him in a situation and did this to him. You practically killed him.
Right. And that recently came up with the Michelle Carter case.
Okay. Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah, I do.
So, I mean, this is something that's very prevalent and has, you know, taken place, probably many instances of this taking place. Like, what is the responsibility of the person that's convincing someone to do this when they are in a vulnerable state?
It's crazy.
And this is a step. This is the furthest I've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, this is bad. I mean, you really are doing this. You know, you're taking people's lives.
Right.
That's what you're doing.
Right. Now, in regard to Mark Drybrow, there was a brief investigation that stated an inquest had revealed that the deceased had been using his computer to gain access to the internet and had entered into a live chat many times. But the Drybrow family read through the correspondences, and what they found was disturbing to say the least. This female nurse that Mark was communicating with had entered into a suicide pact with him. She had also told Mark, who suffered from depression, that people have let her watch suicides before to ensure that it was done right, and she would be willing to do that for him. In fact, there were several cases that Celia found in which Lee Dow convinced people, this is later after Mark's case, to commit suicide in front of their webcams so that they could watch it. And in all of those times, Dow said that there were technical issues, so like that's why he would be able to watch them. So he couldn't show himself on the camera because then those people would realize it's not a woman.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
So they would, and there are people who, there were instances of them saying, you know what, I don't want to go through with this. So that's how we know that's how that scenario went down.
Gotcha, okay.
Yeah. So in his last email to Lee Dow, Mark sent this final message. I keep holding on hope that things might change.
Oh, man.
I'm dying, but slowly, day by day. I don't want to waste anyone's time. If you want someone who's suicidal, I'm just not there yet. You either do it or you don't, and I don't and haven't. I'm used to being alone. Sorry, I admire your courage. I wish I had it. That shows how much that person is pushing him to do it and saying and making him feel like guilty, almost like I'm doing it. Why aren't you? And he's saying, I can't. I'm holding on to hope that there's going to be change. I can't do it. And 4 days later, after that email sent, that's when Mark dies by suicide. And you can't tell me that that person's not responsible.
Oh, no, they're 100% responsible. I mean, honestly, look, in that letter, that message, you could tell that he's the victim here. I mean, you could obviously see that, like, what he's doing is affecting people. This right. is horrible.
Agreed. In addition to the cases of Kat and Mark, Celia heard another young teenage girl who had entered into a suicide pact with the female nurse, Lee Dow. So for months and months, she collected her evidence. Evidence that was all culminated and sent in her email to Detective Bill Hyder with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in Minnesota. So why send it to Minnesota? Well, there's three reasons. First, this is where Celia believed Lee Dow, or whoever they were, lived. She believed that this case involved the exploitation of vulnerable people on the internet. And luckily, Minnesota has clear laws against aiding suicide. In 2008, isn't that crazy? It was passed that anyone who advises, encourages, or assists someone in the taking of their own life would be guilty of a felony.
That's actually, I actually have to commend them for that, because it's, you know, we always talk about, like, currently, like, you know, laws don't usually catch up to the certain, like, crimes that happen online and things like that. But here we are, that, you know, they're looks like they're taking a step in that direction.
Yes.
To try to get you know, ahead of it, so to speak.
It's true. And in this case, I think that applies, but it's a very controversial statute, because really what it's trying to stop is the aiding of assisted suicide when it comes to people who have terminal illnesses or are elderly.
I see. Yeah, right.
But in this case, it seems like that law perfectly fits. But this is rare.
I mean, I think it does.
One would hope so.
Right. I mean, I think it fits perfectly.
Right. But unintentionally. Because sure. It was made for something else.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Now I wonder, like, is it still, like, can you still apply it? Like, even though
yes. We
say it fits, but, like, is it?
Well, its constitutionality is going to be argued.
Okay.
So from all the information that Celia Blay had gathered, despite the campaign she was waging against them, this person who was masquerading as Lee Dow was still active in the suicide chat rooms and forums. There's no fear here.
No, they just keep doing it.
So this piqued the interest of the detectives, because if this were true, this man or whoever he was was preying on people during their weakest moments. When these people who were suffering were doing what society told them to do, to reach out and ask for help. And this is weird here, because this person's claiming that they are a medical professional.
Right. This is worse, because it's they're pretending to be somebody that they're not. Right. And then on top of that, you're trying to push them into doing something that they might not want to do.
Right.
You know, this is like, it's multi-layered here of the wrongdoing that's going on.
Agreed.
For sure.
And this person was asking to watch.
Which is creepy and sick.
Well, basically, all of the work that the detectives would have had to do was already done by Celia. She had given him several email addresses that had been used by this person. So they were able to trace a location and source of those email addresses all back to the same physical address. It led them to the home of the Melchert Dinkles. And it's like a hyphenated name. So this was the home that authorities visited after the discovery of Cammy D emails.
Are you telling? Wait, hold on. Is this the dad? Is this the dad?
In January of 2009, after an intense 6-month investigation in which the detectives in Minnesota had to work with authorities in the UK for Mark Drybrow and authorities in Ottawa, because quickly this case became linked with the assisted suicide of Nadia Kijiji, the Criminal Apprehension Bureau believed they had enough evidence to go to the Melchert Dinkle house and arrest this person. His IP address was traced back to the home in Faribault, which is located an hour's drive south of St. Paul. And because of jurisdictional issues, Detective Hyder was working in conjunction with the St. Paul police to go over probable cause for the arrest. The problem was this, though. The Melchert Dinkle home was home to two nurses. Both the husband and wife were both nurses.
I see what you're saying. So, like, they weren't sure, like, is this the mother
or the
wife?
Yes, or the husband.
Right, because that would fit, right? You know, 30-something
year
old.
Well, they're in their 40s.
Okay. You know, nurse, mm-hmm. you know, they're playing a woman. Maybe they are a woman. I could see where it can get complicated.
Well, although a man was seen on the webcam once, that wasn't enough evidence to assume it was him. So the agreement was that they would visit the house and question the couple with the nod from the St. Paul police to determine who had been at the keyboard for all the damage that had been done. On January 9th, 2009, Detective Hyder and a detective from the St. Paul Police Department drove to the house in Faribault. Once they got there and rang the bell, they were invited in by the seemingly friendly couple that lived there. Although they did not have definitive proof, they believed that the husband, William, had been the one behind the fake personas online because of the time that webcam got him in frame. The detectives noted that he was unremarkable in every way. The men said that they were there because they work for the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. As you can imagine, that's a heavy sentence. Hyder explained that because of their job, they had expertise on internet-related issues. And the husband, William, said, "Yes, we know about that." The detective stopped and asked him what he meant by that. And he said that he and his wife work in the healthcare profession, so they have dealt with people that have had suicidal ideations or depression. Now, that's odd, right? Because it's 2009. So all of our minds, when someone says that they work for Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, goes to the depths of depravity, right?
Right.
Like, I would think of, like, child exploitation, sexual abuse. This guy goes to suicide.
Right away.
Someone's guilty here, right?
Yeah, exactly. This guy was, he thought that he was, this guy thinks that he's way smarter than, you know, he is.
Yeah.
That's what's going on here.
So that was where the detective stopped him and said, "Well, we want to ask you, is this a conversation that you want your wife to be a part of?" And ooh. So after a pause, William Melchert Dinkle said, "No, she has nothing to do with it." In the taped interview, Melchert Dinkle stated, and this is verbatim, "No one else in this house was engaged with this activity." They asked him to walk through what had happened. He said, and remember, this is taped, so this is verbatim. Basically, it's okay. It starts like this. So-and-so goes online and said they're looking for a method. And I have said, "Why do you want to do this? And what's going on in your life?" And stuff like that. He was saying his role was of him as a caring nurse. And if he got questions, he would answer them as a medical professional, but he was always there to discourage it. And then he admitted to using different identities. He said, "I never came out and said I'm a 46-year-old male." He admitted to being Falcon Girl and Lee Dow.
Okay, but you know what? We already have you. You're already admitting to, like, we have everything on file. We have all the records of their conversations.
Right. But it is important for him to admit.
No, I'm glad because, well, I'm glad criminals are stupid, but we have everything. It's not like he could turn around and be like, "I didn't say this." We have it.
Well, he continues to talk.
Okay, good.
He was asked, "Do you consider yourself talking them out of suicide?" And he said, "A lot of times, yeah. And other times, what can you do?" It seemed to detectives there was either a disconnect from reality or he was trying to minimize his role in the deaths of these individuals. They asked, "So as a nurse, how do you feel about advising a stranger about methods of suicide?" And he said, They would say they were looking for more effective methods because people had not completed suicide and ended up in hospitals, and they didn't want that. As he was pushed on more details on PACs and teaching people how to hang themselves, he came around to saying that his interest in internet suicide chat rooms had turned from an advocacy role to something more sinister.
I don't believe that. I believe that this has been his...
Always.
Yes.
He'd always been sinister. Mm-hmm. Like, that's always been the intention.
Yeah.
The detectives, well, that's your opinion, though.
That's my opinion.
For legal purposes.
Sure. I mean,
that's John's legal. That's...
Yeah.
I'm just trying to protect us and our $0 in our bank
account. Hey, listen, I'm just saying, it's just that's what it seems like, but...
The detectives asked him to give them a number of the amount of people that he had been accessory to suicide with, and he said he honestly could not. They asked if he had entered into suicide pacts with people or asked to watch them die by suicide, and his response was yes and no. They then asked him about Nadia Kijiji. They said, "You made a suicide pact with her, and now she's dead and you're alive. Isn't this incredibly manipulative to do that to, like, a vulnerable, impressionable teenage girl?" I added that last part. William Melcher Dinkle admitted to the PACs where he would live, and he admitted that he wanted to watch because he was fascinated with strangulation deaths. This was why he was pushing everyone to die that way, because he said he had an obsession with the act of hanging.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
After this interview, they had to bring in William's wife and explain to her what was happening. She looked and reacted like you would expect, like her world had been pulled out from under her. This was a betrayal of her husband, father of her children, but also of their profession. They were supposed to be helping people. In the end, the detectives got exactly what they needed from the interview. He admitted to being an accessory to suicide, especially in the cases of Nadia Kijiji and Mark Drybrow. He consented for the police to take his computer. Later, through analysis of its contents, they found pictures of people hanging and conversations between him and other people about suicides and hangings. They also found the final email that Nadia had sent before she headed for the Rideau River on that freezing day in March. The reason why he was charged and tried in Minnesota was because, based on their laws and statutes, authorities in the UK and Canada did not believe they had enough evidence against him. But luckily, he was in Minnesota, so he could be tried under American laws. The official charges that William Melcher Dinkle faced on April 23, 2010, was aiding and abetting suicide. He faced up to 30 years in prison.
I'm glad that they're able to at least try to stick this to him and, like, actually go through with
and hold
this.
Him accountable, yes, in some way.
We literally have families in other countries that are praying that this happens because their countries and their laws don't necessarily apply the right way, I guess, or whatever.
Right. And it's actually very complicated because the question then becomes, where was this law broken? And if he's in the United States breaking this law, then it would have to be the United States that tried him.
Right, because he's physically there.
It's complicated.
It's where his base of operation, of his sick, twisted base of operation is.
Right.
It's based on that, you know? At least I would think.
Yeah, it's internet law is complicated.
Because it's almost like, you know, if you're, you know, I'm going to sound like a super old person when I say this, but it's like, you know, the World Wide Web, but seriously, you know, it's like international waters. Where does the laws, how are laws applied and, like, do they matter? That's interesting.
Right. During the trial, the prosecution presented the findings on his computer, the correspondences that he had with the victims, and the interview he had with detectives at his home. Lawyers presented that Melcher Dinkle knew that these people were vulnerable, especially because of his professional training, and still he took advantage of them. His defense team tried to argue the constitutionality of the Minnesota state statute, prohibiting the assistance of suicide. In trial, the professional records of the defendant were released, and it was revealed that he had several reprimands on his record and a history of being disciplined for poor nursing habits. These disciplinary actions included mistreating patients, incomplete nursing care, clinical weakness, unsafe or poor critical thinking skills, medicating patients without making notations on their charts, failing to report medication errors, not notifying or updating physicians on patients' conditions, and later he was fired from a retirement home for alleged abuse of two residents.
So, does this man sound like a good person? Does he actually sound like you want him around?
No.
As far
especially
as like
not in a nursing capacity.
Right, in the medical field or around anyone for that matter.
Yeah.
Because if you could do these things and get written up on these things and nothing's happening to you.
Right. He was still technically like on a restrictive status when during the deaths of those two individuals.
Right. So great. So you can't harm anybody physically at your job because you're horrible. But now you'll go on your computer and take advantage of people there too.
It's very sad.
It's unfortunate.
So this case was taken all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court because of the argument of constitutionality. The argument was that it infringed on the defendant's First Amendment right to freedom of speech, which doesn't make sense because freedom of speech does not include any verbiage that can cause danger or harm. I think what he's doing is far worse than the example that's always given for the First Amendment, which is you can't go into a crowded theater and yell fire because it causes chaos.
Right.
What did he do? He caused extreme chaos.
He did.
And deaths, in my opinion. Melcher Dinkel's attorney stated that his client's actions were unsavory. Unsavory, he said, but not illegal. The trial judge disagreed and decided that he was guilty of assisting the suicide of Mark Drybrow and attempting to assist the suicide of Nadia Kijuji. Now, the reason why it was easier to prove with Mark was because of the email that specifically explained where to place the rope and the ligature marks that were found on the victim.
Okay.
William Melcher Dinkel was sentenced to less than 15 years in prison. At sentencing, it was stated that because he was not the sole reason that these people died by suicide, that they were the ones who completed the action, he got 6 months in jail and 10 years of probation. In the end, when he was released from prison in 2015, he served 178 days in jail.
In my opinion, I think it was a lenient sentence for what he did.
Yeah.
Because to say that he wasn't the only factor in why they did what they did, I don't think is fair.
Well, there were other factors because they were present at the site. They were expressing that they had these thoughts or suffering from depression. Like, that's where the judge is coming from because he didn't physically commit the murders in other countries. So I guess the judge is scared to set that precedent. That's what I'm thinking.
I understand. But don't you think that sometimes there needs to be...
I'm not saying I agree with it.
No,
I'm
no, you're playing devil's advocate, yeah. Which is fine. But I'm saying, but don't you think at some point, at some level, there needs to be, though?
Yeah, I think that it's a good... If any case should set the precedent that if you do something like this, I think it's this one because... His intentions are so obvious, and he said out loud to detectives that he has an obsession with hangings.
Right.
And that's why he was doing this, and he was asking to watch.
Right.
How dangerous can you get?
Especially in today's day and age where we have made so many strides towards mental health and how to help people cope and deal, right?
And to lessen the stigma.
Exactly. So with all that being said, there should be a precedent set. Because nobody should be going around doing those type of things.
I think if this case happened now versus then, the sentencing would have been harsher.
You're probably right. You know, it's just that you hate to see all these victims
you know, and this happens to them. And then it's like, oh, well, you know.
Because there are better places to go now that, that these people sadly didn't have available to them. Correct. Or maybe potentially didn't know about.
You just hate to see the collateral damage. Yeah. Before there is some kind of change or something that they implement to make things, you know, better, you know, like that's the worst part about it all is that people have to suffer and things have to happen before change can be made. Instead of, unfortunately, it's harder to be more proactive about it so that way it doesn't happen at all.
Right.
You know?
It's a sad case.
It is. It really is sad. It's sad to all these poor victims and their families that maybe even didn't know that something was going on, and maybe they feel that, you know, they could, you know, something could be done. You know how it goes. Right. There's so much there, and that's always very painful.
Right. And that's what, like, Nadia's brother's going to say, that, you know, he didn't feel this like massive need for revenge in this case. Rather, he wanted it to become a message that, you know, people, that there is help available for people. And he's now a suicide prevention advocate, just like Celia Blay is. Mark Kijuji is associated with the suicide prevention group Your Life Counts, which I'll also link in the show notes. So I think that, you know, it's tragic. It's sad. We don't know what these people's actions would have been without this intervention. I'm glad that he did receive jail time. I wish it would have been a little bit more, in my opinion. Well, I told you that was going to be a crazy one.
It was. And you got me so angry.
I know. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I mean, you know, it's you hate to see people suffer, you know what I mean? Especially by the hands of someone so sick and twisted doing it over a computer, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's just, it's sick.
Well, that ends it for episode 176. And before we go, what we want to do is we want to say a big thank you to our new supporters on Patreon. So since last episode we released, we've gotten new Patreons. So we're going to say thank you to Olivia Deich, Jennifer, Emily Huerta, Amy Kate, Dina, Jen Paradiso, Beth Smith, Tanya, Jamie, Courtney Scott, Laura B., Danielle Banton, Amy Burks, Momo, Kirsten Kelly, Izzy, Kitten, Jay, Alana, Ann Matta, Chrissy Evans, Lily Burke, Upped Her Pledge, Nikki Rock B, K80, Angela DeKiro, Sonia, Patricia Pano, Nan Johnson, Whitney Pies, Rachel Black, and Kara Wolford. Thank you guys so much, and we hope you're enjoying all of those extra episodes on Patreon. If you want ad-free episodes and 2 bonus episodes a month, you can join us too on patreon.com/truecrimecouple. Remember that all of the resources that I discussed will be in the show notes. And until next time, guys, don't park next to vans.
Bye, guys.
Bye.